just a little girl, I ask my mother, what will I be? Will I be pretty? Will I be rich? Here's what she said to me. Que sera, sera, whatever will be, the future's not ours to see. Que sera, sera, what will be, when I grew up.
Hi, this is Jack Shalom. Over a century ago, revolutionary Rosa Luxemburg starkly declared that there were only two choices before us for our future, socialism or barbarism. Now sociologist Peter Fraes has written a new book which takes its cue from Luxemburg but hypothesizes four different possible futures. Fraes's new book, Four Futures, Visions of the World After Capitalism, presents two possible heavens and two possible hells to which we all may be headed. I'm happy to be talking with Peter Fraes. Welcome, Peter.
Thanks for having me.
In the introduction to your book, you set up a little grid based on the interaction of whether we're going to have a society of equality or inequality, and whether we're going to have, based on the climate and technology, a society of abundance or scarcity. Can you talk about how those factors interact and how that provides your four visions of the future?
Sure. So my starting point in the book, the whole book is kind of a thought experiment. So it starts with a premise of really high-level widespread automation of a world in which we can produce our needs with very little human labor. The figure I use, drawing from speculative fiction, is the concept of the replicator, which comes from the Star Trek TV series, which is a machine basically where you press a button or you give a voice command and it can make whatever you need, and that's paired with some kind of source of sustainable free energy that allows us to have this possibility of totally post-scarcity and post-work future. Starting from that sort of premise, which is obviously an extreme sort of exaggerated premise, then I try to play out, okay, what are the other factors we need to look at? And one is this first axis you mentioned, this distinction between equality and hierarchy. This question of, okay, even if you had these technologies, the question still remains, do we all have access to them, or are they monopolized and controlled by a small elite? And then the other axis is this ecological axis. Like, do we get to this kind of world of free energy and cleaning up the environment to the extent where we can all just live large on our replicators, or are we really talking about a world where the main task is still this task of how do we both clean up the aftermath of capitalism's destruction of the environment and also come up with some way of allocating who gets what are fundamentally scarce resources.
Good. So how about if you just talk about those four briefly, just to give an overview, and then we'll go into each of those four futures in more depth.
Sure. So very quickly, if you're in the box where you have both equality and also we have sort of resolved the ecological question to some degree, you have the world that I call communism, following not the sort of 20th century idea of Soviet communism, but the older 19th century idea of Marx's idea of communism as this post-scarcity world in which from each according to her abilities to each according to his needs, we don't have to worry about work. We more are concerned with our self-fulfillment and having the freedom to do whatever we want with our lives. Then moving from there, flip the switch from equality to hierarchy. What if you have the Star Trek technology, but you still have a class society, and then you get what I call rentism, in which various legal tools, especially intellectual property, are used to essentially keep the potential of abundance away from the masses. Then flipping back to equality, but then switching the ecological switch back to scarcity, you have the world I call socialism, in sort of this, again, 19th century sense of socialism being the precondition to communism, when we still have to have a system of democratic economic planning to deal with the fact that we live in an ecologically limited world. And so that's sort of what that part is about. And then finally, flipping to the most dystopian box, what I call exterminism, which is a term I took from the Marxist historian E.P. Thompson, although he was using it to talk about something slightly different. I use this to refer to a world in which we have both the ecological scarcity impinging upon us and also a ruling class that is still in control and is still trying to keep everything for themselves. and what are the implications of that?
Mm-hmm. So let's go a little bit more deeply into each of these four utopias or dystopias, depending on the configuration. In the future, where we have equality and abundance, that's what you call the communist outcome. One of the possible critiques is that people would not have to work to survive, and because of that, there may be a challenge to a person's well-being or happiness, as if work is necessarily essential to a person's well-being or happiness. Can you talk more about that?
Yeah, I think this idea that we need to derive meaning from work is one that I hadn't thought about that much when I started on this, but when I started to talk about these ideas with people, I would get this anxiety. Wouldn't this future be, I don't know, boring, or it would be meaningless, or people would sort of be adrift? My view is that, in fact, yes, we all want work in the sense of we want meaningful and fulfilling things to do with our lives. I think for most people, that does not generally involve being told to show up every day and take orders from somebody in order to earn a paycheck. I think that's what most people do because they have to. But, you know, people already have hobbies. People already have passions. And even if you just look at the very small sliver of rich people that do have enough money that they don't have to worry about work, sure, some people will just sort of sit around and dissipate themselves. And then fundamentally, I'm okay with that too. But then people get up to all kinds of other projects as well. And we don't worry, you know, about the terrible effect that the lack of work is having on the idle rich. So I don't think we should worry about it for anybody else either, really.
I believe it's in that section that you talk about the decommodification of labor and how important that is.
When I talk about the decommodification of labor, I'm referring to the fact that in a capitalist society, most people's labor is a commodity, meaning that it's all we have to sell. We have our time that we can sell to somebody else who can then use it, you know, for whatever, to produce whatever they want, to profit from it. And what I try to suggest in the book is that we can think about the project of the left, the project of socialism and communism, the project of human emancipation, as being, in a way, about pushing that logic of decommodification farther and farther to the point where labor is not a commodity at all. In other words, we no longer need to sell our time in order to survive. And that's what opens up that space for the kind of pre-development of individuals in a communist society that I talk about.
So how does the necessary work get done?
So if we posit that there are some things that need to be done that cannot be totally automated, which on some level is kind of the dream for me, but if we posit that that's never going to be totally possible, because like raising and educating children, for example, making the next generation of people, on some level that's just a thing that we want fundamentally to be one of the tasks of human societies, right? If we want to have some say in what our future humans are going to be like. So there is these questions of how things get done, but I think what I'm interested in doing is politicizing that question in a certain way. So one of the things I talk about in the book, for example, is the proposal for a universal basic income, which is a proposal for a kind of program that would guarantee everyone some minimal standard of living, like basically a check that gets sent out to every single person, no matter who they are, whether they work or not, regardless of anything. You just get, everybody gets a check that's at least enough to minimally survive. And so then that does leave this question of what would happen in a situation like that, where there are certain jobs that maybe still need to get done that nobody really wants to do. And as it turns out, we have a mechanism currently of determining how that work gets done. And the mechanism is this. The more marginal, the more powerless you are in society and in the labor market, the more you are pushed into those jobs. So that's who cleans the toilets. And what I'm suggesting is that by giving some of those people that are in the lowest rungs of the labor market a little bit more economic power, a little bit more option to turn down those jobs, then we bring into the light the political decisions that we have already made about who does that labor. And maybe we can have a different discussion about how that work gets done, whether it's by making the wages for it much higher, whether it's even talking about maybe we need something equivalent to national military service, except it's like national toilet cleaning service that everyone has to do for some part of their lives. But the point is to bring those political decisions about who does the least desirable work into the light, rather than pretending that it just happens through some automatic functioning of the market.
Instead of the value of work being determined by how much profit it brings in, the value of the work is the social good of that work.
Right, exactly. And in contrast to where we are now, where in some ways it often seems the opposite. Something like taking care of children or taking care of the elderly is you know, badly paid and badly rewarded, and the workers are badly treated, whereas you can go work at a hedge fund and destroy the economy and make millions of dollars, right? It's about inverting that logic and saying, if there's work that needs to be done, we should reward it, and if there's work that's destructive, we should get rid of it. I talk a bit in the book about the way the sort of demands for shorter hours has gotten pushed off of the agenda of the left and the labor movement. And I think part of the reason for that is because employers find it very threatening. They find it more threatening than just giving a raise or giving better benefits, because a worker with time is a worker with time to think, time to read, time to organize, time to demand more. It makes workers dangerous. In the same way that I think having like a universal basic income to fall back on makes workers dangerous, having more time makes workers dangerous, and that's one of the reasons that the employer class is so fearful of it.
We've talked about two situations where we're assuming there's abundance. We assume there's abundance with equality, and that gives us what you call communism, and we have abundance with inequality, and that would lead to what you call rentism. You want to talk a little bit more about the rentism?
Sure. So the central concept here is this category of rent. And rent, if you think about it in its popular sense, rent is like the rent you pay for your apartment or the rent you pay on land. And that's traditionally how it was talked about in because that is the most traditional way in which rents were earned by property owners. But rent in an economic, more technical sense, just refers to a certain kind of profit that you can make where you just make money by owning something and charging for access to it. So this is distinct from the idea of I have a factory where I hire some workers and I buy some materials and I make some stuff and I sell the stuff and I make a profit that way. That's the capitalist, traditional capitalist way of making money. Whereas the rentier way of making money is I just own the land under the factory, and if you want to build your factory there, you have to pay me, and I just sit there and collect the money and I don't have to do anything. And the insight, I think, that I'm trying to kind of get at in the chapter on rentism is that our society has a bunch of property forms that have this same quality, even though they're not these traditional kinds of rent. And so this is intellectual property. This is patents and it's copyrights. It's I own the rights to this song. I own the rights to make this medicine. And therefore, if you want to make or you want access to it, I have to get paid whether or not I'm really doing anything to produce anything.
And why do you feel that's dangerous? Or why is
a
dystopia?
Because I imagine this world, this sort of Star Trek world, where we have these replicators. Imagining this world where maybe we don't have to worry about these questions we were talking about before, about who does the crappy work, because we've automated all the crappy work, except the problem is that when you go up to your replicator and ask it to make you a cup of tea or a new pair of shoes or whatever, you have to put in your credit card because somebody owns the rights to those things, to those patterns, not just for the physical things, but for the very patterns that can be used to replicate those things, and that becomes the new ruling class of a world that has eliminated technically the need for human labor, but has not actually given us access to that potential abundance. And that's what I see happening in some of the fights over copyrights, over patents, over intellectual property, is that fight between people who want access to a potential abundance and the people who are trying to lock that away in a property right that allows them to derive a rent and a revenue stream from it.
You indicate a certain paradox here, which is that if everything is for rent, that it has to be paid for, and where is the money going to come from?
Yeah, so this is the structural problem that this society faces, which, as in all parts of this book, I'm trying to draw out things that I think we see today and exaggerate them into a kind of science fictional future.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In this case, the problem is that lack of demand, that question of you want people to buy your stuff. And so there's some kind of work that has to happen. I mean, you need some people to invent the new things to be replicated, so there's some small kind of creative class layer. You need a lot of lawyers, because everyone could be suing everyone all the time if everything is locked away in intellectual property rights. You're going to need some kind of carceral system of police and prisons and so on in order to punish the people that break all of these copyright laws. So that stuff all exists. But I do think it is a underlying fundamental structural problem in this, you know, this ideal typical future, that people don't have enough money to pay for stuff. And it's why I also bring up the universal basic income again in this chapter, although in a different way, because as you may have noticed, there are people on the right, people in Silicon Valley, people in the capitalist class that have been bringing up the idea of the basic income lately. Their version of it is not mine. I think we have to be very clear about the defects of the right-wing version of basic income, because it often involves doing away with things like a right to health care or to education or to housing. But I think that one of the things that motivates them to move in the direction is a recognition that we have to do something, that if we want people to buy our stuff, they have to have money to buy the stuff. And so maybe what we have to do is hand out some checks and some vouchers, which will eventually come back to us, because otherwise the system is not going to be viable.
Okay, let's now flip the switch on abundance, and let's assume now that because of ecological reasons, we're living in a world of scarcity with resources that need to be parceled out. Talk about the two outcomes here.
And we'll hear the continuation of this conversation with Peter Fraze, author of Four Futures, next week. We'll discuss what the future might look like after capitalism, should the world bring scarcity instead of abundance. This is Jack Shalom for Arts Express with host Prairie Miller, hoping you tune in next week for part two.
It's the end of the world.